Reset the Podcast is brought to you in association with Liars, the non-alcoholic spirits brand that gives everyone the freedom to drink their way.
Hello everyone, my name is Suki Thompson. Welcome to Reset the Podcast, a place for you to get some inspiration and advice to help you live a more fulfilling work life. I do hope that your journey to feel more connected, more inspired, just a bit more energized starts here. Take a moment now with me to reset. Keith Weed has just been awarded a CBE in the New Year's Honours List, and it's not hard to see why. He's one of the most experienced and high-profile men in marketing. He's also one of the most energetic. In this Reset podcast, the ex-global chief marketing officer of Unilever talks about energy and the importance to him of creating a team culture, and why the breakdown of one of his colleagues led him on a path to well-being. Oh, and do stay to the end to hear his fascinating story about the hotel bombing in India. Hi, Keith. How are you?
I'm very well. Nice to see you, Suki.
Lovely to see you. And oh my gosh, what an amazing mojito you've got.
Well, I have to say, the mint, which is large amounts, but I love mint. I'm a sort of mint tea drinker, is from my garden. And it's about, 25 metres from where I'm sitting right now to get a big handful of mint. So I've got a big handful of mint in here. I confess I did not grow the limes, but I did make the mojito.
Very good. Well, I thought that a Liars mojito for you and I is probably a fitting place for us to start our conversations. We've spent lots of time together in Cannes, for which those people that don't know is one of the big marketing industry festivals in France every year. And we spent lots of lovely time there together, haven't we, Keith?
Yes, I think it's coming together as an industry are always good times to sort of take stock, where are we, where we want to go, but also importantly to meet people and spend some time with people and learn from each other. And I have to confess, I think I'm not sure I drank any Liars. There was nothing very non-alcoholic in Cannes, but maybe that's a market opportunity for them.
Maybe it is a market opportunity. Gosh, I think we could have done without quite so much alcohol anyway. And actually, it made me think, one of the things that I always admired about you in Cannes was you had, you used to say that you had about 5 clean shirts and you would be very sensibly driving up and down, changing your shirt so you looked effortlessly cool in all the meetings that you were at. And it kind of made me reflect, you had an extraordinary career at Unilever. Was there a particular moment where you went, I really am probably the best marketer in the world, certainly one of the most influential, because you kind of sent everyone in a flutter whenever you were around?
Well, that's very sweet. I'm not sure that's quite true, but I think I was one of a group of people who were very much trying to shape the industry at a time of massive change. I mean, at the end of the day, marketing and advertising has changed more in the last 5 years than the previous 25 years. And of course, the big thing of that was the internet and all that followed. But it's still changing. So the internet was massive, but of course, mobile changed all again. And we still haven't cracked data, the opportunities of really getting to personalization and individualization as was promised with the internet. But we will do. So I think the shaping of the business, and we've seen with the big tech companies, the unintended consequences. I've spent a lot of time. I went to Silicon Valley very early. It was quite lucky, actually, in some ways. Sort of chose that I needed to understand what was going on. And it wasn't obvious. It might seem so now, but it wasn't obvious back in 2009, 2010, that a soup and soap company like Unilever would need to have a big digital capability. And so as far as that was concerned, I went out there, and those are the days we actually sat down and spoke to Mark Zuckerberg and the like, and spent some time, because they were finding their way as well. And I suppose, I say luck, but, Napoleon says he preferred lucky generals. So maybe I was a lucky general at the time to get out there early. But it meant that I got to know the people and the businesses in such a way that I can really say that a lot of the things that are happening right now, of course, were never intended. But we need to manage them and change and evolve the platforms accordingly. So I spent a lot of time working as on the first Facebook client council, and likewise for Twitter, working closely with the industry to try and shift and change it. And in that, I'm a great believer is you need to live the space. And so you would never imagine someone who only listened to radio have a view about creating a TV commercial. You'd expect them to be able to understand TV commercials. But I think still too often, particularly senior people, are not really engaged enough in the digital world, given that we're spending way over half our media, depending on what markets you are in the world, but way over half our media on digital platforms. And so still too often people judge a brand's advertising by sharing the 30, 20, 15 second TV film or indeed the video, as opposed to really experiencing online. So that's why I am active on Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook. And I'm actually developing a new muscle. I haven't been big on Instagram, but with one of my new roles, which we'll come on to as president of the Royal Horticultural Society, I'm now using Instagram to communicate about plants and gardens and that sort of stuff.
Yes.
Really trying to say is immersing yourself in the big changes has been a big thing. And Forbes and LinkedIn, 3 years on the run, said I was the most influential CMO in the world, and I was the Marketer of the Year from the World Federation of Advertisers. So I've got a few bits of recognition, but hopefully what I managed to do was be some sort of sense of reason and experience at a time of tremendous turbulence in the industry, and tried to help people within Unilever, but also the industry to shape where we're going.
Yeah, and I think you absolutely did that. And when you hear it like that, the kind of massive change that you've lived through, been part of, the journey you've gone through, and I guess being voted the most influential marketer, of course, it could go to your head, although you are very well grounded, I think. But what gives you that sense of gravity? Do you get that from your family? Have you had that from your work colleagues? Where do you find that gravity sits for you?
Well, to be fair, it probably helps being the CMO of the second largest advertiser in the world. So dare I say money talks. And so when I talked, I was being listened to, hopefully, as Keith Weed, but I was also being listened to as the second biggest advertiser in the world. And so that certainly helps. I think it also helps. I was in Unilever for many years. I started as a marketing trainee and worked my way up to being on the operating board, and Uni was fantastic at training and developing people and leadership, etc. So I think I was well developed as far as management development schemes, and I had some good mentors on the way, and people I'm still meeting now. In one of my new roles, I'm on the audit committee of Sainsbury's, and one of the first people I reached out to was Niall Fitzgerald, who was the CEO of Unilever four CEOs ago, and who's chaired many an audit committee, and Niall has been coaching me on that. So these people, and he's long retired, these people are still active in your life. So I think some good mentoring, some good training, and having a reasonable heavyweight company behind me has all helped.
Look, this podcast is all about resetting, and before we come on to a couple of the kind of big resets in your life that we want to talk about, there must be moments in your career where perhaps things haven't gone exactly according to plan, or you've had to reset where you were, do something you hadn't expected. On reflection, share one of those moments with me where you've had to kind of take a different direction, or just change your way of thinking.
Yeah, of course, there's been numerous, and I know it's one of those terrible hackneyed comments, but you do learn more from your mistakes than your successes. And so, if there's only a consolation for someone who's going through a difficult time right now, you will learn so much. And when you come out the other side, which indeed you will, you will have learned a huge amount. And it's a Winston Churchill quote about when you're going through hell, keep going. Is a thought that I sort of remember on occasions. And I suppose the one I would share is this is when I basically spent my career, although I ended my career with Unilever as the chief marketing officer, I'd spent my career as a general manager, as so many people do, running companies. And I'd worked in the US, France, and the UK. I'd had Lever Brothers and a lead of Fabergé, if you remember those companies before we became one Unilever, and in the UK. And everything within that scheme was sort of going well. And I was approached by Patrick Sesco, who was the then CEO. And he said to me, I'd like you to take over the laundry and home care business. So this is Persil and Comfort and Domestos and Cif and sort of things that, you know, serve, you know, clean your clothes, clean your home. Globally. So this was the home care division, as we called it, or the laundry and home care division. And his basic brief was, the trouble is we're losing share. And it's very unlike Patrick. He said, there are a load of losers behaving like losers, which is quite a harsh thing to say.
Yeah, really harsh.
True, but of course, like all things, there's an essence of truth. Well, also, Patrick was a great CEO. He was the one who actually fundamentally turned around Unilever. So in the early 2000s, Unilever lost its way, P&G had won, Unilever were losing. Let's be clear, let's be honest. It was a tough time. We'd sold our frozen food business, we'd sold our prestige business. Household care, which was part of the business I was taking over, Domestos and Cif, was on the block to be sold next. And so I took over this business. Now, I'd been running this fantastic business in the UK, Lever Brothers and Anita Fabergé. So that's everything from Dove through to Persil. And I sort of got to this terrible stage where I'm believing in myself maybe a little bit too much. So I thought, well, you know, I need to go in and sort this business out. And it's a massive business. And these laundry businesses are scale businesses. So when they go well, they go very well because you get the whole scale advantage. And of course, when they go badly and you lose volume, all the costs smother you and you decline and shrink. And so I go in to take over this business and you know, there was a lot of men running this laundry business and they turned it into a big business, which indeed it was. And we spent all our time talking about capital expenditure and investment and R&D, etc. And clearly not enough time talking about consumers. And it's very easy, if you come in afresh, to see things with clear eyes. But we had basically diluted down the formulas to manage the profit line. And the world hand washes. A few hundred million people like you and me who have a washing machine, but the billions of people in the world wash clothes in a bucket in a stream. And they can tell very quickly if your hands are in your product twice a day, whether you're diluting your fragrance or your efficacy, etc. And so I basically made the whole thing focus back to product is hero, which is the line, consumer is king, product is hero, were the two mantras. And I started every meeting with getting people to wash their clothes, wash clothes, hand wash, and get people involved in the product. And I brought in, unsurprisingly, a lot more women, including Eleni Santos, who's now the head of marketing and inclusion and diversity for Unilever. She was then working in Brazil. Eleni Santos was a fantastic marketer, came in to run the Persil brand globally, Dirt is Good, as it's called, it's Omo, etc. And we got back to the consumer, back investing in product, and started building brands. And that, in theory, along with a strategy about taking the fight to P&G, was going to work. Well, 6 months in, it hadn't changed at all. The business was still tanking. And the pressure on myself was coming in immense because I was brought in to turn it around and I wasn't doing that at all. And I really thought that was it. And I remember saying to my wife, do you know what? I've bitten off a bite too many. I'm probably going to have to leave Unilever or get fired. So start thinking about where the kids might go to school et cetera. We'll probably have to sell the house. I'd really got into quite a negative mindset. Although, as Eleni always reminds me, he said, you didn't tell us you thought you couldn't do it. So I carried on the good positive about we're going to turn this around. And The good old fake it until you can make it. We're going to turn this around. But internally, I just thought, wow, this is not going to work. But you know, keeping on the fundamentals and then putting a lot more effort into managing the team. And so, although I'd brought in a few more women at the top, there was some truth in what Patrick said. They were harsh words, but we were no longer playing to win. We were avoiding losing. And so we've got in this whole negative space of managing the business at all sorts of levels, including the people, into avoiding losing territory. And we were losing rather than playing to win. So how are we going to get on our front foot again? And so actually, we had a strategy called a citadel strategy, which, as you've seen in the movie, citadels is when you put a wall around a big business or a big town, and then the enemy comes and starve you out. And that's what was really happening. We had some massive and fantastic businesses around the world. Don't get me wrong, in Brazil and South Africa, so Unilever were winning in many places, but not winning globally. And then we basically step by step hung in there and picked some battles and started winning them. And when you started getting evidence that actually reinvesting in the product, building brands like Dirt is Good for Persil and Surf as a value brand, and indeed Domestos with the germs and etc. So good old marketing, dare I say, good old marketing, but good products. It started turning around, but it was the investment in people. And what I talked a lot about was about people managing their energies individually and helping others to manage their energy too. So, you know, my sort of definition of leadership, I mean, we all have definitions of leadership, but my definition of leadership is helping people be at their best more of the time. So all of us have a bit of brilliance, a big slug of average, a bit of rubbish, yeah? And, you know, if you can stop people being rubbish a little bit more and brilliant a lot more, you can raise the capability of an organization really, really well. Yeah. And one of the things I think people need to get their mind around is this managing energy part, which I'm very happy to go on and talk about. But the bit I really wanted to emphasize was it was a tough time. We'd managed the group, we'd managed the energy, we got people into winning ways again. And when I left 5 years later, so this was 2005 to 2010, the laundry and home care business was the fastest growing business in Unilever. And now another 10 years later, it is still the fastest growing business in Unilever. So not only did we turn it around for the last 10 years after I left and became CMO, which was my sort of supposed reward for doing that, it's still the fastest growing business. So to me, there's evidence that it's all about the people. Of course, you need strategy, etc. It's all about the people. And if you can get people to start playing to win and managing their energies, you can get on such a good fun foot. I had an amazing guy in HR, which I'll come on and talk about as well, Jeff McDonald, who helped me and the people on that journey.
Yeah, let's come on to that, because I love your point about enabling people to be better, to be at their best for more of the time. It's a great, you know, kind of mantra and a leadership ideal to help those people be less bad at the stuff they're bad at and more brilliant at the stuff that they can really do. You know, and we've talked, Keith, and some of the purpose of today is to talk about mental health and well-being and energy. Perhaps we could come back to the moment, and we talked a little bit about Jeff McDonald, who was working with you in HR at that time. What happened to make you focus very much more specifically on mental health of your people and your team to enable performance to improve, but also for people's well-being to increase?
Well, to be clear, I really believe at the end of the day, it is all about the people. And as I say, if you can get every individual to be that little bit better, the overall impact of what you can create is massive. But in doing that, well, first of all, you do need to get the right people on the bus. And we did have to make some difficult people decisions, which, by again, is also stressful, because I'm ultimately a relationships and people-driven person. So for me, I find that quite personally traumatic when you have to start reshaping a team.
And it's interesting, Keith, isn't it? Because, you know, you often look at leaders who've done very well and they all say, you know, you have to get rid of people. Of course, you have to get rid of the people that can't perform or all the changes happen. But it's interesting that actually it doesn't become any easier, really, does it?
No, because at the end of the day, you know, when you're sitting on a strategy, I think the most effective way to get people to engage on the journey is to be clear about a future vision and be able to express that vision in different ways. Some people are more engaged to legacy thoughts, others are about big numbers, a billion, or other people about developing people. So try and find a future vision which can talk to different people in your team. And then really invest in engaging people. So I used to spend a lot of time around the world engaging people. So absolutely, you need the right sort of people. But the vast majority of people, in a big company like Unilever, the vast majority of people are good quality people. And what they probably haven't been done is either led, inspired, or managed enough. So in that sort of path you want to get through when you're sort of trying to turn a business around from at the base level of, sort of resistance where people aren't coming with you to apathy, which is a bit better than resistance but not much, into compliance, which is still bad news because people are now complying but not coming with you, through to enrollment, now we have some magic, into commitment. That journey is a leadership journey to take people through. And so set your future vision, then spend a lot of time engaging people, building relationships, people taking people out that journey. So then you can deliver, make things happen, deliver results. So sort of future engage, deliver is the sort of leadership model I use against that sort of definition of helping people be the best more of the time. And that requires a really serious approach to people management. So you need a team around you. I believe as a leader, you need a support system around you. You need people who know what you're trying to achieve and help you stay connected to what you care about and will embrace the big picture, the whole, as much as you do. You need to work on the little stuff. You know, everything is about building up the little, but you need to embrace the big picture, the whole. And so you end up being guided by the future you want. And that direction, and if you can get everyone along that direction, it's incredibly powerful. But that's when it comes back to one of the people you really need. You need two people in your team. One, you need a great finance person. We can come on and talk about that. But you need a great HR person, a people person, and someone who's going to help you unlock people. And there are some people who come into a room and just suck the oxygen out of the air. And as the oxygen goes out of the air, so goes all the possibilities and opportunities. And people are worrying about, you know, what is the brand share in Birmingham, in Asda or whatever. We're ready to be held to account. And people get defensive and people get smaller. I'm a great believer that if you can bring with you positive energy and help people, as I say, be at their best more of the time, you have more possibilities. And with more possibilities come more opportunities. And with that, more priorities and actions and more results. But if you don't help people manage their energy, and it starts with the leaders, I really do believe it starts with the leaders, because they have a shadow and they create under them, this is the way we do business around here. And I think what you want to do is help your leaders understand the role of, first of all, is managing their own energy. So if you are low energy, no matter how good you are at faking it, you will ultimately bring people lower around you. And that's why I think you need to think about your energies, this sort of physical energy, which I think is very obvious to understand. You know, if you're tired, if you're unfit, if you haven't had a good sleep, if you're feeling under the weather, I think it's very easy to understand. You won't bring positive action, making things happen type energy. I think it's equally easy to understand intellectual energy. You know, we do that a lot in business. It's about thinking, analysis, logic, rational debate. But of course, on the negative side of intellectual energy is criticism and finding fault and suppressing and And all these things, you know, pull down passion and enthusiasm. The two we don't talk about so much, but I think are terribly important in business, is emotional energy. So this is about relationships and you know, being human and you know, people feeling listened to. And if they aren't, they feel, you know, excluded or anxious. And spiritual energy, where we talk about vitality and being alive and in touch with enthusiasm and passion and possibilities. And certainly I believe is these all are interconnected. But if you can help people consciously, particularly people in more leadership positions initially, understand the impact they have on people around them in those different areas, they can identify the people they're working with and help them sort of, you know, be at their best and understand, you know, actually, you know, you should let that person go home early because they're sort of people who don't react well to being a lot of physical energy demands, but, you know, but then be more challenging on their other energies, etc. So understanding people and managing them accordingly. But when business gets tough, and let's be clear right now, life is pretty tough for virtually everyone. And extremely tough, I think, for young people particularly, people who are being challenged about employment. There come a lot of things that start questioning the core of who you are, and the people around you could help support that. And Jeff was a very important person in that. I say 2005, we started this battle to turn the business around, and it started happening in more in 2006, so five is a tough year. But come 2008, Jeff became ill himself, and he had a major burnout. I had had, I'd had friends, close friends, and let's be clear, not the majority of my male friends, the vast majority of my male friends have had some sort of problem at some sort of time. So, to me, maybe I'm unusual, but this idea that people say, you know, half the people have this. No, I don't see half at all. I'm talking about, you know, more than 80% of my close male friends. Like, the reason why I say close male friends, because it's not that if people are close, you actually know, because, you know, people very easily talk about their broken arm or cracked ribs or whatever. But people feel much more uneasy about talking about challenges, either emotionally, spiritually, or through to well-being and mental health.
I think particularly Keith's
wife.
Sorry, I was just going to say, Keith, particularly men, I think, don't you find that it's much more difficult to get that kind of connection, have those kind of conversations if you're men together?
Well, I think so, because... I mean, to be fair to the men, they have been coached all their life in a very, I'm sure, well-meaning way by siblings and parents and teachers to that terrible expression, to man up. I think does more harm than anything else, because what you really need to do is you need to human up. You don't need a man up, you need a human up. And human up has lots of different building blocks. And the building block of humaning up was when I got a phone call from Jeff's wife, Debbie, saying, like, Jeff can't get out of bed. It was Sunday morning. Jeff can't get out of bed. Now, I don't want to, again, use stereotypes and the like, but let me use a stereotype. Jeff is South African. He's a major athlete. I mean, a real athlete. He's just been cycling around northern Scotland. He cycled coast to coast in South Africa. He's South African in the way you would imagine South African. But as he once said to me at the end of the day, it's the reeds and blades of grass that bend in the wind. It's the mighty oaks that crash. And this is one of his phrases he used many years later. At that time, he didn't know what the hell was going on. But he couldn't get out of bed. And because I'd had the experience of seeing a few of my friends going through this, not that I'm a doctor, I felt immediately that I sort of knew where he was. And because he was willing enough to sort of open up to me that he was having a problem, I obviously then, as his boss, gave him the space to take time off and recover. But we did more than that because I spent a lot of time with him, visiting him, chatting to him. He didn't want to feel disconnected from the business, but he didn't want to be in the business and the and that sort of stress that the business was sort of laying on him. And it really made me believe and understand that the most important thing we can be is human in our leadership, because this is payback tenfold. Because now, by the way, you know, Jeff now is a really close friend of mine. He's no longer working at Unilever, but he went on and in 2012, a friend of his committed suicide. Again, a stereotypical banker who had everything under control until clearly he didn't. And it made Jeff convince himself that he could have a bigger impact if he wasn't working for Unilever, that actually he left Unilever and dedicated himself to Jeff McDonald's Consulting, as it is called right now, and to go out and help people really talk about and bring into the open the notion of mental health and help people ask for help and help people ask for help. It's as simple as that. He was part of the catalyst for really changing Unilever's global approach to well-being and mental health. And at the same time, 2008, very tragically, a very close friend of mine, Roger Kerman, who worked for Unilever, committed suicide. And again, inexplicably to me, because Roger was an usher at my wedding, a lovely man, again, another sports person, very bright, very, very capable. And obviously life got far too much for him, and you know, he left behind a beautiful and lovely wife and three beautiful and lovely children, and it's such a shame. And I didn't really identify then, I wasn't close enough to it, I think I might now, but you know, he turned down a few dinner invitations, which wasn't like him, but he seemed to be normal at work. And you realize that people are very good at keeping a facade up for an extended period of time. And so ask people how they are, especially when you notice they're acting a little bit different. And then saying, no, really, how are you? Mm. And when they say, oh, well, work's a bit different. I think the sort of the three or four questions and drilling down, of course, you don't want to get too intrusive if you don't know the person well, but I think we all know the people who work around us reasonably well, and certainly well enough that when you notice really different behavior changes or mood changes over an extended period of time, that you owe it to them and to yourself as a human to try and bring it out. And what we did at Unilever was got senior people to talk about mental health, and you know, our head of R&D, David Blanchard, talked about two of his children. One of his children who had mental health problems, which he basically felt he couldn't tell anyone about. And at the time, his other child had broken his arm, which he felt very happy to tell people about. He's only broken his arm and couldn't do sports. Mm-hmm. And he shared within Unilever, why was that? And so we had people, and Jeff in Unilever shared his journey. And I think he came back a better person, dare I say. Still sport and mad and South African, yes. But also I think more of a human being. And I think we can all learn from these episodes. And I learned a huge amount, not just from Jeff, but from Unilever and from Roger, God bless him. And I just wish I could wind back the clock. And if I was the leader that I am now, back in 2008, maybe I could have done something different, but yeah. I just missed it because I didn't know enough. And that's why I love to encourage us more to learn.
Yeah. And it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, that must have been so hard to live through that with your close friend, Roger, to have seen the impact on Jeff. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because even when you talk about Roger committing suicide, it's an extraordinary expression, isn't it? It's like something you do again as a terrible thing, whereas actually, you know, he took his life tragically. Now, I wonder why it is when we have, you know, mental health has very often quite derogatory connotations, expressions, whereas physical health, breaking a leg, you know, and the kind of visuals that we have for physical health tend to be very positive, but mental health are not as positive, and they're very difficult. So that stigma runs very deep, even into the words that we use.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's also maybe it's because we don't understand enough, or maybe it's because we're all a little bit frightened about it. But there's that hopelessness, which maybe comes out in our language. And I think the more you lean into it, maybe the easier it is to deal with it. And you've done a huge amount of brilliant work in this area. So I bend to your better understanding and judgment on this. But in physical health problems, we sort of know that the body will mend. You know, it might not mend 100%, it might be 95%, but yeah, it will mend. But we are less clear on the path of recovery on mental health, and it's more invisible as well. And maybe that's the thing that makes people feel uneasy. And that's why I love the idea of talking and we're talking right now about this topic to get people to think about it. And I also like to think of it in a spectrum as well. So this isn't a binary thing that, you know, you're well, you're not well. No, there's a whole spectrum. This is why I think the thought around energies really help. And think about your, you know, intellectual, emotional, spiritual, physical energy, to think about where you're going, things like purpose. And I've done a huge amount of work on purpose in Unilever, and brand purpose and personal purpose, and how that can be a light to draw you into the future and guide you at how you go. And it's only if you get lost on that direction that ultimately you can then fall into a mental health issue. But I think there are signs that can help you avoid those challenges earlier if you are have ability to pick them up yourself personally, or a colleague or a friend, or B, have some tools to help you address them. And this is what I think we're talking about.
Yeah, this, again, and I'm really interested in your perspective on this, Keith, because, and you could argue, look, Unilever was the second largest, a massive company globally. So to invest money in purpose, in well-being, in mental health, in all this sort of leadership is vital. But also you could argue that it's a relatively wealthy company, so of course it would invest in its people in that way. I think the challenge for most organisations is they say, yep, it's important, but it's not that important. We're not really going to spend any money on it. We're not really going to focus, you know, even with having purpose at the kind of core of an organisation, let alone that for people. What is it, do you think, that still stops organisations really taking this seriously and investing as much time and effort in it as they might some of the other things that they measure at kind of board level?
Yeah, I think part of the challenges of our business is they measure what they treasure, and what gets measured gets done. And you know, business needs to have very clear approaches to objectives and plans and strategy. The things that can be measured very concretely are therefore things that do get a higher value. And of course, you know, when you think about stakeholders, you know, one of the stakeholders that's been very central to business has been shareholders. And in that, you know, numbers like sales, profit, cash flow, costs. These are things that you can measure very easily. And when you look at resources that companies have, optimizing your resources, and you're talking about financial resources, are very clear and evident. And by the way, it's so clear and evident that if you do it badly, that can be seen very quickly and you can be fired. And if you do it well, it can be seen very quickly and you're promoted. And if you go back to the olden days of businesses, initially were sort of invented to serve people and make some money on the way. You know, the early days of Lord Leverhulme back in the 1800s, he saw the challenge of the dirt and squalor of Victorian England. And he had a purpose statement back then to make cleanliness commonplace, to make cleanliness commonplace. He wanted to take, you know, soap to the masses. And to this day, Unilever is still the biggest soap company in the world. So I think he probably succeeded. But he saw multi-stakeholders. He saw society. He brought in pensions and holidays, etc. I think what happened somewhere in the 80s and 90s, business got a little bit lost into selling more stuff. And the selling more stuff, I think, put a lot of pressure onto the numbers. And if you focus on the numbers, somehow they get better. And I don't believe that. I think you have to focus on the things that lead to the numbers and they get better. And I think the change of the title of personnel into human resources was a really good step. I don't know whether we've totally unpacked that enough. They are humans and they are resources. So, you know, if you were overpaying for electricity, or if you had a factory line which was underperforming and you needed to have it updated, you would. So why would you overpay for the resource, human resource of an underperforming human, because you're not investing in them to be at their best more of their time? You know, most businesses have human resources as one of their biggest costs and also one of their biggest enablers. So I think it's not a big business thing. In fact, to be perfectly honest, one of the things I do right now is I angel invest in small companies. Small companies really invest in their people because they know they've only got six of them. So if they don't succeed, then it falls apart. I think it's the companies in the middle that are maybe are most challenged. And I think it comes back to not having a multi-stakeholder approach. One thing that I hope will come out of post-COVID, and you know, governments are now more involved in businesses and the role of society, that businesses, and we did a lot of this work, because when I was the chief marketing officer of Unilever, I also ran sustainability, so environmental and social sustainability, and I led the development of the Unilever Sustainable Living Plan. And the Unilever Sustainable Living Plan was a multi-stakeholder approach, so we did, of course, look at business results and delivery to shareholders. But we said our first priority is our consumers. And if we serve them well, you know, everything else will get better. And, you know, and after our consumers is our employees and our customers and our suppliers. And if they all work well, you know, our shareholders will be well rewarded. And this is written down. So it's quite an overt statement. And indeed they were. So those 10 years when I was the chief marketing officer of Unilever, our business grew ahead of the market every single year. Our business grew in profit. We also had a really positive impact on our share price. It tripled. And this is, as I say, super soap company, not a tech company. It tripled over that period of time. So I think you can get great business results if you take a multi-stakeholder approach and realize that the people who are going to get you there are your employees. And no matter how brilliant you are as an individual, you can't do anything unless your employees believe in the future and are engaged and working towards that future as much as you are and delivering against that future as much as you are. So I think it's getting this idea of multi-stakeholder approach into business. And one of those stakeholders, of course, is employees.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then just finally, Keith, you know, probably the biggest reset that many people who've been in very successful careers, like you've been in, you know, for a long time in that pressured environment of then coming out of that and going into a more of a plural working environment. I mean, you're certainly no less busy, I would say, but you have, you know, you've lost weight. You actually seem, I mean, I think you've always coped with pressure very well, but I wonder whether some of the experiences of people like Roger, of what you've seen with Jeff, with other of your friends over time, has made you reflect and over time changed. But also, how are you looking at your new part of your working life now and resetting for the future?
Yes, it is probably actually my biggest reset. There have been lots of different steps and chapters in my life, but unlike a lot of people who have gone around and done multiple different types of careers or gone to different companies, I stayed at Unilever for a very long period of time. I would say, again, maybe the size of Unilever, it enabled me to have lots of very different experiences around the world. I enjoyed... I've got to say, I enjoyed every moment. I enjoyed nearly every moment while I was there. And I'm still very close to the business. But, I wasn't getting any younger in my late 50s. I'm lucky enough to now have a lifestyle and resources to not needing a big salary job to continue my lifestyle. So in that term, I'm very fortunate. So I thought... it had all gone very well, thank you very much. Paul Polman resigned and left Unilever, and Paul had put me into my job. The wonderful and marvellous Alan Jope was coming in as leader, and it seemed a very good time, because I certainly wouldn't want to sign up for another 5 years to then move on to something different. And I didn't want to sort of wait until I was 65 and then sit in a deck chair and in fact, actually, my grandfather retired and then died the year later, which obviously you don't want to do. And so I wanted to change the way I was doing. Now, you say I'm no less busy. I am a lot less busy, to be clear. So I work 4 days a week. And of course, you'll dip in a bit outside that. But if you're working in a job at the top of a company like Unilever, you know, you're working 6+ days a week, along with a ton of travel. When you find yourself in hospital in Singapore, in the very aptly named Glen Eagles Hotel, you think, thank God I was in Singapore on that particular medical challenge, as opposed to many other places I could have been around the world. So you start thinking that, I was in the Taj Mahal Hotel, the Taj Hotel terrorist crisis as well. So you start thinking about how...
Oh my gosh, all these things we haven't talked about, Keith. Me.
You're thinking about how lucky am I going to be? And I'd loved being the CMO of Unilever. I think it literally is the best job in Unilever. So I've got a portfolio career. So I have the business bit. So I am a non-executive director of WPP, which is the largest marketing, advertising company in the world, going through transformation, as indeed the industry is. Unsurprisingly, I co-chair the Sustainability Committee, which has just been set up, so still building my sustainability. Sustainability, as you'll see, will run through a lot of what I'm doing. I am a non-executive director of Sainsbury's, so sort of two FTSE 100 companies, where I'm on the Sustainability and Corporate Responsibility Committee as well. I'm an advisor, so I have Keith Weed Limited. I'm an advisor to different companies, whether it be startups like Tribe, Great Business, or McLaren Formula One, also to private equity. So I've got sort of a business thing, but that's about only half what I do. What I've constantly done is look at civil society and how I can... That corny phrase, give back, but it is actually, it's sort of things I've enjoyed over the years and how I can help. So I'm on the board and a trustee of Business in the Community, which is the Responsible Business Network. There's fantastic stuff about helping businesses contribute to the broader society and the role they have, dare I say, with a multi-stakeholder approach, to engaging with the societies they serve. And I really believe you can't have a healthy business in an unhealthy society. I'm also president of the Advertising Association. So this is carrying on a little bit of trying to address some of the challenges we have in the advertising and marketing industry. And I've been doing quite a bit of work in that area, especially around COVID. There's lots of challenges in the advertising industry. I'm also president of the Historic Advertising Trust, which is a fantastic charity, which does work from... having an archive of the largest advertising archive in the world, through to dementia patients And surprisingly, they can remember the 30-second TV ad they saw many, many times, decades ago. Even they can't remember their child. But not to go too much detail on that, but it's another great charity. But the one that I'm very proud to become president and chairman of the board of is the Royal Horticultural Society, the RHS. So that's the RHS Chelsea Flower Show. And
It's just such an amazing, I've told you before, my mum and I, for the last 15 years, on the Wednesday morning, she's an RHS, very proud RHS member, have been to Chelsea every year, apart from one when I had a Macmillan board meeting and I couldn't not go, on that Wednesday and go to Chelsea together. It's a very important part of my life. And it's an extraordinary, brilliant, well, charity, I guess, but organisation, isn't it?
Yes, and I think stories are bring to life. And yes, it is a charity, I hasten to add, and it has, this year, it will lose £18 million worth of income it would have had. So, like so many charities, it's in a very challenged time. But, of course, it does stand for the, you know, quality of fantastic gardening and horticulture and the shows and the gardens. Again, I think there's a huge opportunity here to bring sustainability in a much more active way. Gardeners, what's more green than being in your garden? But you won't be surprised, mental and physical health, you know, being out in the garden, doing something. We're building a new garden up at Bridgewater near Manchester. And what's interesting there is we've got, we're trying something with local doctors who are actually prescribing working in the garden. In that gap between someone who's had a mental health challenge but is not yet well enough to go back to work, to get them doing something again, get them out into a garden. It's fantastic, nurturing nature, seeing things grow, and also a bit of physical exercise as well. So I'm president of the RHS, and then I'm also a trustee of Grange Park Opera, which is we built a new opera house a few years ago in Surrey, and it's a country house opera, and it's again, I think, a wonderful sort of spiritual way of engaging people in the arts. And then I'm also doing a little bit of work with the Cabinet Office, and last but not least is angel investor. So I'm an angel investor in 5 startups right now. And I'm going to slowly build it up to maybe about 10, but I'm enjoying that. But the main reason for doing that is to keep myself relevant. So all I'm investing in are things on the tech side, and everything from influencer marketing through to gig economy and data, etc. So a portfolio which is balanced between sort of not-for-profits and business, yes, a major reset for me, but I'm loving it. I love the diversity. I love that I can have a theme that runs through all of these around sustainability, environmental and social sustainability, and also a theme that runs through all these about inclusion and diversity. And I'd put the sort of the mental health and well-being under social sustainability in my sort of language. So it sort of fits together. It's very exciting and very, very different from what I was doing before.
Yeah, amazing, amazing, and amazing you can do all that in 4 days, Keith. Well done. I can't believe that. Now, just before we go, I need to ask you about Taj Mahal, because I didn't know about this. Tell me what happened. Were you there when it was bombed, or were you there near that time?
So I was staying in the Taj. The team were all there. There was a person in reception waiting to greet me from the airport. I'd been down to Bangalore that day. The whole of the Unilever board were there in the ballroom. Paul Palmer was taking over from Patrick Sesko. They were up in meeting in one of the ballrooms, along with the whole board of Unilever. And my laundry team were there and staying there. And I'd been down to Bangalore and had come back, and the plane luckily was delayed. As we drove into the airport, they had literally just struck and had gone through reception. And we know the Taj well. Our Indian business is a very large business. We're very careful. Mm-hmm. And people at the door just screamed at the drivers, you know, drive, drive, drive. And we had this little convoy of I suppose 4 or 5 cars. So we drove off. But then, by then, there were bombs in the roads, etc. So we went off through the slums, which in itself is quite interesting. Yeah. But I had another team in the Hyatt in my oral care team, my dental team in the Hyatt. So we managed, and they closed down all the hotels. We managed to talk our way into the Hyatt because I knew the names of the people who were staying in the Hyatt by using their names.
Right.
And then I got all the dental team out of bed and paired people up with the laundry team who we had in the car and put them to bed. And then I was up all night along with Jeff McDonald again, talking to people who were still in the hotel, including, of course, my CEO, Patrick Sesko, because I was then the person who said, sort of take command outside the hotel because everyone was in the hotel.
They kept them in the hotel. So if they were in the hotel, they stayed in the hotel. And if, as you were out of the hotel, you were out.
They literally locked the doors of the room they were in, as is Patrick and literally heard the terrorists rattling the doors. They turned the lights off, went under the table, rattling the doors, and then going to the room next door and heard people being shot in the room next door.
Oh my God.
And the person who was greeting me in reception shows the level of fear. As they came in with their guns, he turned, and he turned so fast he ruptured his Achilles and fell on the floor, which it saved himself because then they shot a lot of people in reception. And he crawled into a cupboard where he stayed for the next 36 hours. So after it was over, we were scouring the hospitals trying to find this particular person. And he just stayed in that cupboard, too terrified to come out. And you can imagine, we talk about mental health issues. He had a few challenges following that.
How did you feel at that moment?
It was tremendously traumatic, but it's amazing how you click in, because I was having to speak to wives of people who are in, and when the fire started, I had one person who was in the old part and said, stay in your room is what we told everybody. He said, I can see smoke coming under my door. What do I do? And I said, look, I honestly don't know what to do, but let me tell you what I've seen in the movies. It's as basic as that, is get a load of towels, get them wet. If you want to go, wrap yourself and your body in the towels and go, or stay in your room, because the advice is stay in your room. But if you do feel you need to go, that'll do. And very, very sadly, on that same corridor, the manager of the hotel's wife and children stayed in the room and were burned to death. So if he hadn't left that room, so he did get out and got to the fire extension, and then everyone was coming back to the Hyatt. So I was greeting people back at the Hyatt, but there was another person on the 15th floor and sort of trapped there. And his wife kept saying, I can see on the news, fire engines, can't they put a ladder up to him? And then you're saying, well, he's on the 15th floor, the answer is no, But I was speaking to them all through the night and basically just rolling from all the people I had trapped in the Taj. But you actually become, well, certainly I become, very calm in some way because you have to be. And we got people together every hour in the Hyatt just to give them an update and, of course, celebrate as each person came out and joined us. So we sort of piece by piece got people out. And I should say that it was the Indian Army who got the board out ultimately, but I was more focused on getting the laundry team out because the Indian business was focused on getting the board out. But it was a very traumatic period of time where, of course, back to physical energy, I didn't sleep for quite a considerable period of time and had to keep going. But you learn from these things. And the great news is no one got injured physically. But yes, we do have people who were hugely impacted mentally and some who left Unilever and had to do a different life following that because they couldn't get their mind around being in that situation.
Yeah, gosh, I'm not surprised. Well, thank you for sharing that. Keith, it's been an absolute pleasure. You talked about energy and the mental well-being, the physical well-being of people, the spiritual well-being. I always love the phrase, be a radiator or a drain. And you are one of the best radiators that I know. It's been an absolute joy to talk to you. Thank you very much.
And I've enjoyed talking to you as well. Thank you very much, Suki.